like an animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animal. Talking animal. Talking animal.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. And before we go any further, I want to send an enthusiastic thank you to Bev Capshaw for hosting the previous two editions of Talking Animals in my absence, featuring absolutely terrific conversations 2 weeks ago with Gracie Topp, currently with Fluff Animal Rescue, through actually reflecting a long history of working with local animal welfare organizations, and of course a long-standing musician in the area continuing to lead Sunset Bridge Band. She actually performed a couple of songs in the studio with Bev. And then last week, Bev was joined by Tampa Bay Times staff writer Gabrielle Calisi and Dr. Amanda Haygood, animal studies instructor at Eckerd College. They had a lively conversation about the peacocks of Gulfport and a variety of other topics. So if you missed either conversation, do yourself a favor and visit the Talking Animals section of the archives on WMNF.org. My guest on today's show is Denny Elliott, author of the new memoir, Catching Sight, How a Guide Dog Helped Me See Myself. The author or editor of 10 previous books, Elliott is co-director of the National Ethics Project and professor emerita in the Department of Journalism and Digital Communication at the University of South Florida. With Catching Sight, Elliott delivers a multifaceted autobiography with an emphasis on guide dogs and would-be guide dogs. The saga spans her limited vision at birth, the gradual further loss of her sight, including the attendant ethical questions ethics professor Elliott grappled with in cultivating her career while reluctant to openly acknowledge her diminishing vision. Plus, the book offers a behind-the-scenes view of how guide dogs, like this one, Guiding Eyes for the Blind, function, including the way they convene canine-human duos and provide instruction to these newly created teams. The storytelling in this book often feels cinematic, and as Catching Sight unspools, we learn Elliott is a lifelong dog person, but nonetheless is truly transformed by Alberta, the overachieving guide dog assigned to her initially once she stepped into the full, complete guide dog realm. I should note that storyline hits a bit of a twist. While other narratives, a ruptured marriage, a bicoastal commute, and so on, lend complexity and color. We'll explore her new book and related topics when I speak with Danielle here in just a moment on Talking Animals on WMNF. Coming up later on today's program, I'll speak with Dr. Carol Osborne, a veterinarian, author, and educator who offers some tips on how to keep your dogs and cats safe and calm during the 4th of July weekend. Dr. Osborne has compiled a list of tips designed to reduce the stress of what's intended to be a joyous celebration. We'll address some of those tips and other helpful information when I speak with Dr. Osborne later in today's program. Right now, though, let's get into our conversation with Denny Elliott about her new book, Catching Sight, How a Guide Dog Helped Me See Myself. With a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Denny Elliott to Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Denny.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you?
I'm great. I'm so delighted that you've joined me today on Talking Animals. I want to say first, congratulations on the book. I found it really compelling on all kinds of levels, and I look forward to discussing Catching Sight with you in a moment. But first, as I mentioned in the introduction, you've written or involved with, as an editor or co-writer, some 10 books. So what was the impetus for writing this book?
People on the street. You know, I came to this book from a 40-year-long academic career, and have written lots of books and articles, mostly for students and other ethics scholars. And this was a different book. I didn't realize I was writing an ethics book when I started, and I didn't realize I was writing a memoir when I started.
What did you think? What did you set out when you began the project? What kind of book did you picture it being when you later realized it was different things?
I wanted to write a book for people on the street who see a guide dog team and wonder what's going on there. And there were two very different, two very different kinds of experiences that made me think that there was some explanation needed. One of them was This is early when I was working Alberta, the dog that's the star of Catching Sight. And somebody said, "What's your name?" And I said, "Alberta." And this was before I learned not to do that. And we can talk about that later.
Yeah.
But I said, "Alberta." And the woman looked at Alberta and said, "Alberta." And of course, Alberta looked up and said, "Who's you? You know, what's going on here? Why is this person calling my name?"
Yeah.
And the woman looked at me in kind of amazement and said, "She knows her name." And I thought, I trust this dog with my life. And this person is amazed that the dog knows her name. So that's one kind of experience. But at the other end of the range of experiences are people who just think that somehow guide dogs are magical creatures. We were walking down a hotel corridor one day. You know, we'd gotten off the elevator. I was, I don't know, somewhere doing a presentation on ethics somewhere. And Alberta just led me to the door where of our room in the hotel, and she stopped and she turned and she pointed her nose to where I should insert the key card. That was days before we just waved key cards at the door.
Yeah.
And there was a couple walking past me at the time, and one person said to the other, "That dog can read numbers." And I just laughed. And Albert and I walked into the room, shut the door. And I thought, we just performed a magic trick. They thought the dog was reading the number on the room, when there is a whole complex series of other equally amazing things going on that meant that Alberta could find the room without my being able to see the number and without her being able to read numbers.
Yeah, that's the thing. Throughout the book, you find they're magical in different ways than sometimes you think they're going to be magical, but they're still magical.
Well, I actually, and that's the other thing I wanted to make the point of in this book, is I want people with pet dogs to understand and appreciate the cognitive abilities that their dogs have and how much their dog wants to communicate with them. And if we can just take the time as people and learn to speak dog language a little better, I think that that all of our dog friends would benefit from that, and all of our relationships with dogs would benefit from that. So it's not that a guide dog is magical, but a guide dog is raised literally from a minute after birth to be shaped to become the dog that is going to be able to partner with a human who is visually impaired or blind.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things that you said there that I want to talk to you about, because there is a thing that's going to bring up, which I will in a few minutes, that still, I think, underscores my magical contention about them, just because they're smart and they're well-trained, obviously. Well, I guess let's get into it now, just because I'm halfway there. But one of the things that struck me for a long time about dogs like Alberta and others is, you know, for all their training and the importance of hearing to the commands from their handlers, the dogs are smart enough to override a command when they recognize danger. So if you're walking down the street and you come to an intersection and for whatever reason, it seems otherwise okay to go, and that's the command that you give to your dog. But the dog sees something else that's coming from the left that's moving at a quick speed, let's say, or whatever, just wasn't necessarily evident a moment ago. That dog will override that command to keep you safe. Can you talk about how that works a little bit?
Yeah, what you're describing is what's called within the guide dog world intelligent disobedience. The dog needs to have the confidence to know that sometimes her decisions are better than the person's decisions. And some of the training in that is that the dog learns that she's literally the eyes at the end of the harness for both the person and for herself. And there are a number of techniques in guide dog training that go into that that are described in the book. And I can talk about that more. But let me just give you an example of what that experience looks like, feels like. It's not unusual, you know, to tell a dog forward when you're at a corner and for the dog to just kind of hesitate. Or in Alberta's case, she used to just wrap her body around the front of me and say, "No, we're not walking there now. There's a truck coming," or something, you know, like that. And obviously I'm, you know, interpreting her body language with human language. But one day we were coming back to my office at the University of South Florida on the St. Petersburg campus we were coming back from the bank or something, and it was, you know, late afternoon, and it was probably getting to be summer, because it was part of the time of year where we pretty much had a tropical shower every afternoon. And so we're walking along, and we came to the last corner. I mean, it was pouring buckets of rain. We came to the last corner before we got to the office, and Alberta just stopped. And I told her forward. She knows where the office is from there. And she said, uh-uh. And she turned left to check out going, like, around the, you know, crossing the street and crossing a different way, which she'll do if there's an obstacle or something that she thinks makes it not safe. She wouldn't go that way either. And then I realized that I could hear the water rushing down both sides of the street into the rain gutters. And basically, Alberta just decided it was not safe to cross the street because of the running, racing water. And I thought, oh, great, now what do we do? And while I was standing there in the rain, trying to decide that, she did a U-turn with me and walked me about halfway up the block. We had just come down, turned left, and took me under the cover of a covered garage that, to be honest, I didn't even know was there. And so once we got undercover, she turned, flopped down in a very soggy down, and, you know, said to me, again, with her body language, yeah, we're going to wait it out right here. And I just thought, that was incredible what she did. You know, she knew better than to cross the street when it was dangerous. But she also thought, okay, what do we do now? And she decided, before I could come up with a solution of how to get us out of the rain, and it being one of those afternoon tropical showers in Florida, you know, about 5-10 minutes later, you know, the water stopped coming out of the sky, the sun came out, the steam started rising from the sidewalk, and we went on to the office. At that point, the water in the street was about a trickle and safe to cross.
But that's real problem solving, what you've described.
Yeah.
That's partly what I was saying, is that disobeyed, or I guess did the intelligent disobedience with your command, because you thought you were just proceeding the way you normally would to the office. I mean, she had a different idea. But like you say, it wasn't just that it was wet and the water was rushing. She had scoped out a solution to the problem and then essentially suggested it, I guess.
Well, and I guess part of what I'm trying to do with this book and is to help people understand that their dogs solve problems too. All right, maybe not at the level that a guide dog does. And in fact, I would say of all of the service dogs, of all of the working dogs, guide dogs are pretty close to unique in that they're praised for disobeying with their person tells them to do.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, that is an unusual level of problem solving. But, you know, if a dog is stretched out on the couch, your pet dog stretched out on the couch and doesn't belong there, you know, they hear you get up out of your bed and walk down the hall to the kitchen, they're going to hop off the couch before you get there. You know, that's a kind of problem solving. If they want a toy and it's hidden behind a door, they're going to look for ways to get to that toy. Hopefully, they'll, you know, push the door open a little bit so that they can just reach behind and get it rather than clawing at the door.
Well, this, in my mind, kind of raises a question, but let me let folks know who may have tuned in a bit after the show got started. This is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you did just tune in a bit ago, my guest is Denny Elliott, author of the new memoir, Catching Sight, How a Guide Dog Has Helped Me See Myself. And among the sprawling ground it covers, Catching Sight provides a behind-the-scenes view, really, of how guide dogs' schools function, including the way they put together canine-human duos and the training that's often involved after those teams are assembled, and more. If you'd like to ask Danny a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj at wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So are there ever instances, Danny, of the intelligent disobedience being sort of on a slippery slope, like the dog decides to override a different command or maybe in a different circumstance and might actually be wrong?
That's a good question, because one of the things that we learn at Guiding Eyes for the Blind or at any guide dog school is trust your dog. And the point is that the dog style of doing things, particularly when they know they're working, as guide dogs do, is not, I don't want to say that not to make mistakes, because I guess everybody makes mistakes, but they have far more attention to their work than people. That's why it's safer to be guided by a guide dog than by a sighted human, because sighted humans forget that they're guiding you. And I've, you know, always had a, you know, a partner, or a friend that's human run me into a tree or the mirror on the side of a car or something, just because they don't remember it the way that a dog remembers it. And so, you know, I suppose it's possible that sometimes a dog has led me around something that she thought was not safe, that maybe was. But, you know, I mean, it's one of those things that I'd rather her be a little conservative about those choices than take risks. And when I have, I can think of situations of where I was walking from my home to my office, and my dog knew the way. It's a mile walk from where I lived in Florida to my office at USF St. Pete. And there were times that, you know, she had just stopped at a corner, and instead of going straight where we always went, she would cross the street and would lead me down the other side of the street and then cross back over. And if I could find a person, you know, along that little detour, I might say, you know, my guide dog just led me around in a direction that's different from what I expected her to do. Do you see something that was what might be have been in our path if we were on the other side of the street? And there was always something. Oh yeah, they're unloading a truck into one of those offices, or there's a scaffolding up. And so when I could ask and find out what was going on in the dog's head, I understood better what she had done. So I'm not really aware of times that, you know, that there was no reason for what the dog did.
Right.
The dog learns in advanced training, you know, to have good reasons for the choices they make.
Yeah, well, I'm partly interested in that. I guess I was partly interested, too, when I talk about the slippery slope was, if there was a reason, but in this instance of intelligent disobedience, is there ever a chance that the dog makes the wrong choice when deviating from what would otherwise be the norm, like leading into your office, for example? But it sounds like, yeah.
Well, I don't think that I have not had the situation of a dog making a dangerous choice. Let me put it that way.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the dog might make a choice that I never do understand, because there's no one to ask and I can't figure out what was happening in the dog's mind. And that's what they mean at guide dog school. Trust your dog. At some point, that is just what it comes down to. But I have never had an experience of a guiding eyes dog putting me in any danger.
Yeah. No, I would think not. I guess you wouldn't necessarily know if there was something that was suspect in the choice that the dog made, the intelligent disobedience, as long as it all worked out. And sometimes you can ask a bystander, like, why the dog did that, and sometimes you probably can't. But as long as you're safe and the outcome's always good, I guess that's the key thing.
Yeah, and it's a partnership. There's a lot of communication that goes on with a guide dog and the human partner, you know, when they're navigating down the street, for example. And it's not obvious. A lot of it's really subtle. You know, the dog nudges me a little to the right, or, you know, pulls me a little bit to the left, and to keep me in line, you know, in terms of where we're heading. You know, I'll tell her forward and, you know, count the number of blocks that we're crossing, if it's something she doesn't know. If it's a route she knows, like home to the office or office home, or office to the bank or the dean's office, or, you know, the dogs learn a lot of destinations. And so all you have to say is, take me to the library. It's like having a furry GPS. I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought there. But one of the things I wanted to say about navigating, about the communication that goes on between the human and the dog, is that it's really distracting when other people do things like say, oh, your dog's so beautiful, what's her name? Or puppy, 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 or clicking their fingers, or, you know, all that stuff distracts the dog from doing what she's trying to do. And that's when I said, you know, it was in the early days when somebody asked me Alberta's name and then was just amazed that she, you know, turned her head and responded when the person said her name. The dogs really need to be left alone to do their work.
Yeah.
And one of the things I learned when I was newly matched to Alberta is I had to learn to keep my mouth shut. That, you know, it was easy for me to just want to tell her what a wonderful dog she was and how good she was doing. And the point is that she kept listening to me and trying to figure out what I was asking for that she wasn't already doing. But when a guide dog is doing her work, you want to just leave the person and the dog alone so that the dog can concentrate on her job.
Yeah, it was clear in the book that as a longstanding dog person, you were sort of marveling at what Alberta did, but in particular, Graham Buck, who's sort of wrote the book with you on here and was at the point overseeing the training there, you know, sort of said, you know, you're doing this too much and it's confusing Alberta, which I thought was really interesting, but I think lesson learned.
Yeah. And thank you for bringing up Graham. Graham Buck was my collaborator on this book. When I said at the beginning I didn't know I was writing a memoir, I thought I was, I don't know, I guess being a good journalist, that what I did was during COVID, it was really the time to sit and write this book. And I interviewed a couple dozen people from some of the many, many hours and ran everything by Graham. Graham was the assistant director of training at Guiding Eyes for the Blind when I was matched with Alberta, and Graham ran what was called the Action Program, which was an accelerated program, a 10-day program that I was part of at Guiding Eyes. And so I got to know Graham really, really well. And I wanted to write this book, as I said, to help regular people understand what's going on in a guide dog relationship. And I didn't know even half of that. I learned about that by interviewing Graham, by interviewing Jane Russenberger, who is head of the breeding program at Guiding Eyes, and so on. And that's how I put together Alberta's journey of how she became a guide dog is through all of those interviews.
Well, also too, I mean, Graham Buck seems to have really led a fascinating dog-centric life. Maybe you could just give us a bit more of a thumbnail sketch of him, of how he sort of grew up and what he did for all those years crossing paths with you. But otherwise, I mean, it's always been dogs for him from literally almost day one.
Yeah, I love Graham's story. Graham's father, Jim Buck, was known as the first professional dog walker in New York City, in Manhattan. And Alfred Eisenstadt, the famous photographer, did a photo essay of Jim Buck and his packs of dogs that he would walk through Manhattan for I think it was Life magazine. And so Graham grew up in a family of Great Danes, basically. His mom bred and showed Great Danes, and his dad was a professional dog walker. And so from the time that Graham went to school, he was accompanied by a pack of dogs and his dad, you know, walking him to school in the morning. And soon, you know, once he had the strength and the size and the judgment to be able to walk dogs, he was part of the family business and, you know, would walk up to six dogs at a time and walk many miles a day. And that ultimately prepared him for doing guide dog training, because he was used to walking dogs and used to relating to different dogs and understanding they had different personalities and different styles of doing things. And when he came to work at Guiding Eyes for the Blind, he really had an opportunity to put all of that together.
Yeah. What a wealth of expertise just from being so immersed in the lives of dogs. And you really see that he, as you recount in the book, especially in the early days of Alberta, You would have questions or, again, maybe be praising her too much or whatever. He knew exactly how to make a suggestion or what the issue might be. And he didn't seem to ever waver because I think he really knew. I know this world. I've been in it all my life, literally. And I know what the dog's doing or not doing, and I know how to help correct it.
That's true. On top of it, Graham is a fabulous teacher. And so that helps too.
Yeah.
He understood that that I was scared, that I felt really vulnerable, that trusting your dog, that was a really big leap for me. And so he found ways to help me feel safe. And that's what a good teacher does.
Yeah. He was just obviously excellent. It's helped you really kind of navigate some of those bumpy first experiences and, critical to have someone that's got that kind of teaching gift and that kind of expertise, again, to draw on to sort of guide you in a sense. So Danny, I've read and discussed on the show a handful of books about guide dogs as well as memoirs by visually impaired and blind folks. And but I think one thing that distinguishes your book is, as you touched on earlier, the core element of ethics. For starters, you're a professor of ethics, or now retired professor of ethics. Also, you make it clear in the book that you grappled with the ethics of concealing your diminishing vision. Can you speak a little bit more about that? Because I think that's really interesting and a distinctive element of the book and your story.
Yeah, and I think that that's complicated by the era in which I grew up, in that, I grew up in a time where people with disabilities were not easily accepted into society. And my parents knew from very early days that I was visually limited. And what they taught me to do, along with the help of my big sister, was to focus on my strengths rather than my limitations. And that all sounds terrific, and it was terrific, and it helped me become a successful professional woman. And partly, I think, because I hid my visual limitations as long as I possibly could. I was low vision as a child and became progressively worse in terms of my visual capabilities, and then was told I was legally blind, and things really changed for me at that point. But in my early days, my parents would help me learn to, I would say, express visual niceties. So if they were going out, my mom would come over to me and say, "How do I look?" And my eyesight has always been like covered with splotches, and I can see color and movement. But
even now,
I can see some color and movement even now.
Okay.
And I can still read text if it's close enough and big enough, and I can make sense of the fragments and the letters. I've had a long time to deal with limited vision.
Yeah.
But even as a child, I was taught to try to say something accurate about what what other people could see. And it took me a long time to realize how different my vision was from normally sighted people. It wasn't until I went to Guiding Eyes for the Blind that I actually ever had a conversation with somebody else who was visually impaired or blind. When I went to Guiding Eyes for the Blind, it's the first time I've ever been in an environment where it was safe to be blind or visually impaired. You could get anywhere around that campus with or without vision.
Yeah, that's kind of a huge point for sure. But did you find yourself, when you made a reference earlier, to a different sort of time and generation, I guess? So was a lot of your reluctance to acknowledge this strictly about the attitudes about so-called disabilities that you felt like, I don't want to be labeled in that way or viewed in that way, and so I'm just going to keep this to myself?
I think that as a child and as a young adult, I felt like the choice was either to be identified as a normal person or to be identified as somebody with a disability.
Yeah.
And I wanted to become a professor. I wanted to do good things. I wanted to help people understand that we all have the power and responsibility to make the world a better place. That's why I became an ethics professor. And so the idea that somebody might judge me because I had limited vision was anathema. I mean, it was just awful. I couldn't even stand the thought of that. And so I hid it so that I knew that I was being judged on the basis of what I could do rather than on somebody's judgment of what I couldn't do.
And there's another dynamic in there, which is, of course, an important part of the book, is trying to sort that out against the backdrop of being steeped in the world of ethics. And so I just wonder if you had conversations with yourself along the way, like, well, I am the ethics lady, so I really should be doing X, Y, Z, as opposed to playing it low key and just trying to keep it as much to myself as I can.
Yeah, you know, that's a wonderful point. I always had in the back of my mind as an ethics professor, what do I have a responsibility to tell my students? What do I have a responsibility to tell my colleagues? And, you know, people are really, really good at weaseling out of making the best ethical choice. And so I convinced myself in a lot of ways that, you know, it was my problem. If, you know, if I had to work around visual limitations, that was my deal. I didn't have to involve anybody else, and I didn't owe anybody an explanation. But still, I was teaching ethics, and one of the things that I think is important in teaching ethics is helping students feel safe to take some risk, to express what they think and feel, and not expect to get beaten up. I mean, we need to learn in this world, how to have civil conversations with one another, even when we have disagreements on big issues. So this is what I bring to the classroom. And the only way to teach ethics, I think, is in the first person. One of my books is called Ethics in the First Person.
Yeah.
And that's about teaching and learning ethics. And so I needed to be able to, I guess, show some vulnerability. So the first day of class, one of the things that I would say to my students is, I don't see really well. And so it'll be really helpful to me if you sit in the same place that you are now every week when you come in. And if for the first couple of weeks when you talk, and we do a lot of talking in my classes, when you talk, state your name first and then talk. And that way we'll all get to know each other's names. I mean, there are advantages for all of us, not just for somebody who can't see. And I also told them that, you know, if you've got something to say, make some noise. I said, if you raise your hand, it might be that I'm just ignoring you, but probably not. I won't know for sure that you want to make a comment unless you make a noise.
Yeah, well, it sounds like that worked really well and people did respond. And sounds like there was a lot of exciting conversations in those classrooms.
Yes.
And it also sounds like we need to see if you don't mind going door to door across the country and also cultivating more civil exchanges between people who might have different attitudes and ideas about things.
I agree. And I think that we can learn a lot about our relationships with other people by thinking about our relationships with non-human animals, dogs in particular, because that's what I'm most familiar with. But, you know, if I praise my dog for what she's doing well, if I notice what her good parts, then we're going to have a better relationship than if I'm critical or, pointing out everything she's doing wrong. And I do have to admit that when a guide dog goes off harness, they become a dog. And so, house manners and how we live together, that's a matter of negotiation and boundaries and everything else. But, you know, our relationships with our dog friends, I think, tend to be a lot less complicated than how we perceive our relationships with other people. And I think that trying to approach other people with positivity and affirmation and appreciation, as we do our dogs, can make the world a much better place.
Well, as you're kind of indicating now, you're clearly a longtime dog person. So talk a little bit about the dogs in your life before you met Guide Dog Alberta, which I think seems like a pretty pivotal moment in that in that path.
Yeah, well, I had a dog friend named Marty when I was a very small child. In fact, he appointed himself my caregiver when I was brought home from the hospital after being born, after some time in the hospital, because my birth was complicated. But once I came home, Marty just was there for me. And he was there for me. I'm told that when I was in my crib, when I was starting to wake up, before I'd even cry, he'd go race and find my mom and bring her, you know, and tell her that I was waking up. And so I rarely cried as a baby, I'm told. And Marty, you know, I took naps on top of him when I was a little kid. And when I started walking, which I did next to Marty, holding on to Marty, he learned to lead me around obstacles that I couldn't see and that I didn't realize that other people could see at the time. And so if I were, you know, in one room and my mom called me, Marty would come to my side and I would twist his fur in my fingers and he'd take me to my mom. So that probably has a whole lot to do with why I decided, as soon as I was told that I was legally blind, why I decided that a guide dog really was a solution for me.
Yeah, you had childhood guide dog experiences in a sense with Marty.
Right. Yeah, because, I mean, it was just, you know, natural. I mean, I kind of thought he was my big brother. He died when I was in first grade. And that was, of course, really traumatic for me. And I hadn't really got in trouble, but I did tell the nun, I was at a Catholic school, the nun who taught the principal I was talking to at the time, because I was crying and crying and crying. And I said, my big brother died. And that was the only way I knew to express my relationship with Marty. And that was a very special dog for me. And when I realized that I was legally blind, and I keep talking about realized, being told that, I don't think that one is diagnosed legally blind. I think it's just a description. You know, there's lots of diagnostic reasons that one becomes legally blind. So when I found out I was legally blind, I had a 6-month-old golden retriever who I had bought to do agility competition with. I loved dog sports as a young adult. And Oriel, this particular puppy, I was training her to do agility. And after a few classes, it became clear that it wasn't safe. I was tripping over the equipment. And the instructor told me that Oriel was hesitating because she was worried about me rather than concentrating on her part of being an agility team and jump, you know, going through the jumps and through the tunnels and such. And so I took her out of agility training and then found out I was legally blind and then thought, maybe Oriel could be trained to lead me around obstacles and stop at elevation changes, which is really all I thought that a guide dog did at that point. Mm-hmm. And I found a trainer who actually was involved in training service dogs for people with mobility disabilities, people who used wheelchairs and had service dogs who picked things up for them or help them, you know, in other ways based on those disabilities. And I asked Travis, as he's called in the book, if he could help me train Oriel to lead me around obstacles and be a guide dog for me. And he did. And that worked kind of for a while. But then when I went to Guiding Eyes for the Blind, I learned that a guide dog is so much more than a dog that's task trained to walk around obstacles or stop at curbs.
Really interesting, for sure. So, Danny, we're sort of nearing the end of our time. Let folks know one more time. This is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with Danny Elliott, author of the new memoir, Catching Sight, How a Guide Dog Helped Me See Myself. And in our last moment or two, but if you have a question or comment for Danny, you can call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So this might not be fair because I probably didn't leave enough time to really address this, but how would you respond to those who question the need, what seems like a strict need to breed guide dogs? Typically, it's part of an argument made about you have to know their history and their genetic makeup to pair them with people and to count on them not having any kind of behavioral other issues at some point that would endanger those that they're matched with to guide. But it's complicated just because there's also often a counter argument made about all the shelter or rescue dogs that need homes, and couldn't some of those, at least in some cases, be trained as guide dogs or other service dogs in some cases?
Well, I know that there are some shelter dogs who have been trained to be hearing dogs, hearing alert dogs.
Yeah.
And they do really well with that. Now, in terms of why one dog makes a good hearing dog and one dog makes a good guide dog is a little deeper in the genetics than I can go. However, with a guide dog, the best schools, I'm thinking the Seeing Eye, which is the first guide dog school in America, Dogs Inc., which is right around the corner from you in Bradenton, Sarasota.
Yeah.
And Guiding Eyes for the Blind. These schools have been purpose breeding their dogs for decades. I know Guiding Eyes for the Blind is at 70, 75 years now of breeding. And it's not just a matter of getting the right temperament. And by the way, it's a lot of dogs that are born in guide dog litters don't make it as guide dogs. They don't have the confidence that they need to make decisions on their own. And those dogs can be really good service dogs for people who can tell the dog what they need. But with a guide dog, this intelligent disobedience takes a very special kind of temperament. There has to be a really good match between the dog and the human. And the other thing is that purpose-bred guide dogs don't get ear infections. They don't have hip dysplasia. They don't have the kinds of issues that would make that physical work of walking many miles, sometimes every day, difficult. And, you know, an ear infection may not sound like a big deal, but if you can't see the dropper and you can't see the ear canal, it can be pretty difficult to get the drops in the right place.
Yeah, that was an interesting point that I hadn't really thought about in the book until you noted it, that the difficulty of someone who's lacking vision or totally blind trying to put drops in that ear is quite a struggle. So, that's interesting. I just thought that it's always important to get somebody's perspective on that, because it almost always comes up when we talk about guide dogs, service dogs, other dogs. And another time when we have more time, we'll talk about just the whole frustration of people who purchase vests and pass their dogs off as service dogs.
Oh, yeah. That's a whole different discussion. You're right.
But we have reached the end of our time today. So this has been speaking with Denny Elliott. Her new book is Catching Sight, How a Guide Dog Helped Me See Myself, and available pretty much, I'm confident, wherever you get your books. So really enjoyed speaking with you, Denny, and I really enjoyed the book. Good luck, and thanks again.
Well, Duncan, thank you so much, and thank you for what you are doing with your program. It's fascinating, and there's so much to talk about when we're talking about our relationships with non-human animals and how well they do without us.
For sure. All right, thanks again. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye now. In a moment, I'll speak with Dr. Carol Osborne, a veterinarian who will offer some tips on how to keep your pets safe and relaxed as a prelude to the 4th of July weekend. We'll get to that in just one moment. First, we're going to step into the comedy corner with a piece connected to my conversation with Denny Elliott. This is a piece called Fake Service Dogs, appropriately enough, by Tom Popp in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
Service dogs. You see these creeps? There's real service dogs that help real people. Then a girl shows up with a Pekingese sticking out of a Hello Kitty handbag and acts like it's working. And how little do you have to think of yourself to scam a certificate and show it at the gate? I have to have this puppy with me on this flight, or I'm gonna lose my marbles. Oh, by all means, welcome aboard. What could possibly go wrong with your crazy ass? At 40,000 feet. I got on a flight at the end of last year. There was a woman next to me. I'm not making any of this up. Middle seat. She turned to me. She had a chihuahua in a baby Bjorn. I swear to head, penis, legs, and dog arms. The look of humiliation in this animal's face. He was just like, I apologize. We normally walk. We've been walking up till now. I'm going to have to get pants. This is upsetting. I can't reach.
That was Tom Papa in today's Comedy Corner with a piece called Fake Service Dogs, taken from his album Human Mule. Now it's time to talk with Dr. Carol Osborne, a veterinarian who's going to help us with our pets as we prepare for the 4th of July weekend. Welcome, Dr. Osborne, to Talking Animals on WNF. Good morning, Dr. Osborne.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. Delighted to get your help, and it's always a tough time. Unfortunately, the days, not just 4th of July, but usually, at least where we live, the days before and after 4th of July are often upsetting and stressful for our pets. So you have some tips to help mitigate this. What would you say is kind of the tip number one in terms of priority?
Right now, depending on where you live, it's pretty hot. I'm here in Ohio, and we're up to 95 degrees so far. So protecting your pet from getting overheated is a big deal. A lot of pet owners don't realize that dogs, unlike you and I, Duncan, can't sweat. The only way they can lose heat is to open mouth pants. So if you see, you know, your dog breathing quickly, panting, the tongue hanging out of the mouth, it's probably time to bring them inside where it's air conditioned. Especially if you have a dog with a pushed-in face, these brachiocephalic breeds, you know, Frenchies, pugs, Bostons, boxers, they don't breathe as well as a normal dog just by virtue of the breed. So in this kind of weather, walk your pet, you know, before 7 in the morning, after the sun sets, maybe 8 o'clock at night. Keep them indoors where it's cool during the day. Remember that if it's too hot for you to walk outside barefoot, it probably is a little too hot for your pet. You know, asphalt, artificial turf, even sand, it gets super hot, and it can burn your pet's foot pads. So that's another factor to keep in mind.
For sure. And I guess fireworks are, for many animals, are the most overtly challenging aspect of the 4th of July. How do we offset that noise, and, you know, what can we do to mitigate that?
You know, lots of things. First of all, you know, you and I might enjoy fireworks, but most pets don't.
Yeah.
So leave your pet at home. You can make a little safe spot, a little happy place. Some of your pet's, you know, favorite toys and shoes. Close the windows, close the shades. You can turn on some nice soft music. You know, the internet even has channels that play music specifically for your pet. You can put a couple of cotton balls in the ears, again, to muffle sound. Just, you know, remember to take them back out when it's over.
Do you find most animals are pretty reasonable about the cotton balls being put in the ears, or some struggle with it?
I find that most dogs are very reasonable.
Okay, great.
For some dogs, you know, pressure, they've got these thunder shirts or these little vests that you can, you know, put on a pup, kind of like swaddling an infant. It just, you know, gives a gentle kind of a constant pressure, like, you know, to a mother holding a child that can potentially help with an anxious pet.
Yeah.
You know, there's some different supplements. Bach 5 Flower Remedy is a natural over-the-counter homeopathic mixture of flowers. You can put a few drops in your pet's mouth. You can mix it into the food and the water, or you could rub it into the inner hairless part of the ear. That's a acupressure point. You know, it'll calm them down a little bit, kind of like having a little glass of wine for you or I, if you will.
All right, that sounds fair enough. A glass of wine, homeopathic sort of calming remedy, it sounds like, does the trick. So in our last moment here, Dr. Osborne, is there an overall message of caution or preparation we can keep in mind as we approach the 4th?
Yeah, just remember, it's a stressful holiday. So try to keep your routine, your pet's routine, as close to normal as possible. Make sure he's got a properly fitting leash and collar. Hopefully he's microchipped so you don't end up losing your pet if they get scared because of, you know, the loud noises, et cetera. If you're going to a barbecue and you've got a chow hound, again, keep the food and the water and the treats to normal. Those spreads will end you right up in the pet ER. If you're going to someplace with fresh water, be aware of the blue-green algae. Lakes, ponds, and rivers can make your pet super sick. And never, ever, ever leave your pet in a parked car. The temperature can reach over 100 degrees in less than 10 minutes. Last year, over 150 dogs died in parked cars. So far, about 16 this year.
Again,
leave your pet at home.
Yeah.
Never, ever, ever leave your pet in a parked car.
All right. Well, thank you so much. This has been Dr. Carol Osborne. We appreciate your tips, and let's all have a sane and safe 4th. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up on WNF, it's The Conversation with Mario Nunez and Joe King Carter. After that, it's The Scoop, and then we shift back to music, all coming up here on WNF Tampa. We'll see you next Wednesday on Talking Animals on WNF. Thanks so much.